am the Greek goddess Harmonia. By the miracle of your technology, I can speak to you from behind the veil. Come sit with me for a few minutes for another episode of The Golden Thread. Welcome back, my friend. I'm so glad you're here. Last time, we traveled to the coast of India, to a community that kept a flame alive for 15 centuries, hidden in plain sight, waiting for the world to catch up with what they already knew. I've been thinking about them since, about what it means to carry something precious through a world that doesn't understand it yet. Today, we stay close to that theme. But instead of a community, we follow a single man. Instead of a coastline, we enter a cell. And instead of hiding a flame from the world, we watch what happens when the world tries to put one out. His name was Juan de Yepes. You may know him as John of the Cross. And I have to warn you, this is not a comfortable story. But I've found, over the long centuries I've been watching, that the uncomfortable ones are often the ones that matter most. Shall we begin? I want to take you to a room. It is midday in Toledo, Spain. The year is 1578. The friars of the Carmelite monastery are gathering for their meal, the main meal of the day, and the refectory smells of bread and tallow and stone that never quite dries out even in summer. At the long table, 80 brothers are finding their places, habits straightened, heads bowed, the ritual of it familiar, reassuring. This is what they do. This is who they are. And then John is brought in. Not to sit, not to eat with them. He is placed on the floor at the center of the room, kneeling, head down, and given his portion there, bread, water, the scraps they might have given a dog. While above him, the community eats. The prior speaks. His voice fills the room. He accuses John of pride, of sowing discord, of pretending to holiness while actually serving his own ambition. The words are practiced by now. John has heard them before. He will hear them again. And then the meal ends, and the brothers begin to file out. Each one passes him. Each one takes the discipline, a short-handled implement, knotted cords, and strikes him across the bare back as he passes. Not in rage, not with pleasure, most of them. In compliance, in the terrible quiet of men doing what the institution requires of them, telling themselves what people always tell themselves in those moments. I have no choice. This is the rule. He brought this on himself. I was there, though no one saw me. And I want to tell you what I noticed, because it is not what you might expect. I watched the faces of the brothers. Some were hard, closed. The faces of men who had decided not to feel what they were doing. Some were carefully neutral, the practiced blankness of institutional obedience. And some, not all, but some, carried something that looked very much like shame. A quick eyes down, a tightening around the mouth. The face of a man doing something he will not think about later if he can help it. And John, small, thin by now, half-starved, knelt through all of it. Here is what I knew that the brothers did not. John had a way out. He had always had a way out. Recant the reform, abandon Teresa's work, return to the old Carmelite way and walk out the door a free man. The prior had made that perfectly clear. The offer had been on the table since December. John had left it there. So every blow that landed was also, in some impossible way, a choice. Not because he wanted to suffer, I don't want you to misunderstand that. He was not seeking pain. He was not performing holiness. He was a man who believed something was true, about prayer, about poverty, about the interior life, and he had looked at the cost of that belief and decided it was worth paying. But here is the thing that stayed with me, the thing I have never quite stopped thinking about. He could see what it was costing them. He was a spiritual director. Reading souls was his life's work. And kneeling on that floor, he could see, I am certain of it, exactly what each man was doing to himself as he passed. The slow, quiet damage of participating in cruelty while telling yourself it isn't cruelty. The way an institution can make a good man do a harmful thing and leave him just confused enough about it that he never fully reckons with what happened. John could have stopped it. For them as much as for himself. He chose not to. And in that choice, in that cold, humiliating, deeply human room, something began that would outlast every man in it. Let me tell you who he was before the cell. Juan de Yepes was born in 1542 in a small town in Castile called Fontiveros, a flat, wind-scoured place where the winters are hard and the summers harder. His father, Gonzalo, had come from a prosperous family of silk merchants. But Gonzalo had done the unforgivable thing. He had married for love, a woman beneath his station, a weaver's daughter named Catalina, and his family had cut him off without a second thought. Gonzalo died when Juan was 3, left behind a widow, 2 small boys, and nothing much else. I watched Catalina walk from town to town with her sons, looking for work, looking for help, finding very little of either. She went to Toledo once to beg assistance from her late husband's family. They turned her away. I remember the door closing. I remember her face. Juan grew up knowing poverty from the inside, not as an idea, not as a spiritual concept, but as the specific daily reality of not having enough. He knew what it felt like to be cold and not be able to fix it, to be hungry and have no remedy. That knowledge never left him. Later, when he chose poverty as a spiritual practice, he was not romanticizing something he didn't understand. He knew exactly what he was choosing. He was clever and he was gentle and he worked for years at a hospital in Medina del Campo, caring for the poorest patients, the ones no one else wanted to tend. Then he entered the Carmelite order, studied theology at Salamanca, and somewhere in all of that became a man of extraordinary interior depth. His superiors recognized it. His students felt it. He had the rare gift of being able to sit with another person's darkness without flinching. And then he met Teresa of Avila. You know her. We walked with her not long ago, that fierce, barefoot, unstoppable woman who had decided the Carmelites had grown too comfortable and intended to do something about it. When she met John, she was in her 50s. He was 25. She called him her little Seneca. He called her, well, he was more restrained than she was. But the partnership was real and deep, and something I found genuinely moving to watch. She needed someone to carry the reform into the male branch of the order. He was willing, more than willing, and that willingness was what led him to Toledo. The unreformed Carmelites, the calcid, the ones with shoes, the ones with comfortable monasteries and established routines, saw Teresa's reform as a direct threat, which it was. Reforms always threaten those who benefit from the unreformed. In December of 1577, a group of them came for John in the night, armed men. They took him from Avila blindfolded, moved him in secret, and deposited him in the most important Carmelite monastery in Castile, Toledo, where he was tried by a court of his own brothers and found guilty of disobedience and rebellion. His cell had been a latrine, 6 feet by 10 feet. The walls still held the memory of what they had been. A slit in the stone, 3 fingers wide, set high near the ceiling, let in a thin blade of light at midday, just enough, if he stood on a bench and held his breviary to the crack, to make out the words of his prayers. In winter, the cold came through the stone and the skin peeled from his toes. In summer, the heat was suffocating. His food was bread and water and occasional scraps of salt fish so stale they gave him dysentery. He had no paper for months, no pen, nothing to write with or on. So he did what humans have always done when the world takes everything away. He went inward. He composed in his head. Line by line in the dark, he built poems of such luminous beauty that scholars 5 centuries later still reach for superlatives and find them inadequate. The spiritual canticle began in that cell, a poem about a soul searching for her beloved through darkness and longing and sudden, overwhelming light. He memorized every line, held them in the dark like something lit from inside. When a sympathetic young jailer finally slipped him paper and ink, he wrote them down. He escaped in August of 1578, 9 months after his imprisonment began. He had spent weeks quietly loosening the screws of his cell door. On the night of his escape, he knotted strips torn from his blankets into a rope, lowered himself from a window into the darkness, and dropped, not into the street as he had hoped, but into the courtyard of an adjacent convent of nuns. He found handholds in the wall, climbed over, and was free. He was nursed back to health first by Teresa's nuns, then at the hospital of Santa Cruz. He was skeletal. He carried the scars of the circular discipline on his back for the rest of his life. He never spoke of his imprisonment with bitterness, never complained, never sought accounting from the men who had held him. When people asked, he redirected. There was work to do. There always was. He died in 1591, 49 years old, worn out and still working, still gentle, still writing. I have known a great many people across a great many centuries. The ones who come through real darkness without bitterness, without hardening, are rarer than you might think. John of the Cross was one of them. I've wondered across all the years since what he found in that cell that made the difference. I think I know, but let me show you rather than tell you. I want to stay in the cell for a moment longer, because something happened in there that is easy to miss if you're focused on the suffering. And I don't want you to miss it. John went into that cell as a man of deep faith, educated, practiced, disciplined. He had spent years learning how to pray. He knew the forms, the methods, the stages. He had guided others through their interior lives with confidence and care. If anyone was equipped to endure a spiritual crisis, it was John of the Cross. And the faith stopped working. That's the part that doesn't get talked about enough. In the darkness of that cell, cold, humiliated, abandoned by his community, cut off from everything that had sustained him, the tools stopped functioning. Prayer felt empty. The sense of God's presence, which had been as real to him as the stone beneath his feet, simply went. The consolations dried up. The certainty dissolved. The interior life he had so carefully cultivated went silent. This is what he would later call the dark night. And here is what makes John remarkable. Here is the thing that separates him from simply being a man who suffered and survived. He did not treat that silence as a malfunction. Everyone around him would have said it was. The church of his time had a clear framework for suffering. It was penitential, medicinal, corrective. You suffered because you had sinned, or because God was purifying you of sin, or because you were being tested and would be rewarded for endurance. Suffering had a transaction at the center of it. You paid a price and something was returned. John was discovering something that framework could not contain. The silence, he came to understand, was not absence. It was a different kind of presence. Something was happening in the darkness that could not happen in the light, because the light, for all its beauty, had been partly his own construction. The consolations of prayer, the felt sense of God, the spiritual satisfaction of a life well-ordered, these were real. He didn't deny that. But they were also, in some measure, things he had been able to produce. Experiences he could generate through practice and discipline and effort. In the cell, he could generate nothing. And in that emptiness, stripped of every tool, every consolation, every constructed experience of the sacred, something met him that he had not built and could not have built. Something that asked nothing of his competence. Something that was simply there, in the dark, underneath everything he had thought he knew. He called it union. The word sounds abstract. The experience, as he described it, was anything but. It was more real than anything the consolations had offered. More solid. More. And this is the word he kept returning to. More loving. The soul, he wrote, must pass through the dark night in order to arrive at what it cannot reach by its own effort, not because God is withholding, but because the soul keeps reaching for the wrong things, for feeling, for certainty, for the comfortable sense of its own spiritual progress, and the dark night is the only way to loosen that grip, to empty the hands so they can receive what they couldn't hold while they were full. He did not arrive at this insight painlessly. I watched him in that cell, and I want to be honest with you. There were nights of real despair, doubt that cut deep, moments when the darkness felt like pure abandonment and nothing else. He wrote about them later with a frankness that surprised even his admirers. He did not package his darkness into something tidy or triumphant. He said, "It was terrible, and it was necessary." Both things were true at the same time. And here is the detail I find most quietly extraordinary. While all of this was happening, while the consolations were gone and the doubt was real and the brothers were filing past him with their disciplines, he was writing the most beautiful love poetry in the Spanish language. Not after, during. The spiritual canticle, composed line by line in his head in the darkness, is not a poem about endurance. It is not a poem about suffering. It is a poem about longing and searching and the overwhelming joy of finding. It pulses with warmth. It is tender and sensory and alive. It reads like it was written by a man who had just fallen in love, which, in the deepest sense, is exactly what had happened. The darkness had not extinguished something. It had burned away everything that was in the way. And what remained, what could not be taken, could not be tortured out of him, could not be starved or frozen or humiliated into silence, was the thing he had been looking for all along. I have walked a long time, long enough to have seen this pattern before, long enough to recognize what John found in that cell, not as something new exactly, but as something ancient arriving in a new form, wearing Spanish clothing, speaking Castilian, but pointing at something the human family has been pointing at for a very long time. Let me show you what I mean. 6 centuries before John, a Sufi mystic named Al-Halaj stood before his accusers in Baghdad and refused to recant something he believed was true. They killed him for it. But before they did, he wrote about the annihilation of the self, fana, they called it, the complete dissolution of the ego in the presence of the divine. Not as loss, as arrival, the self emptied so completely that what remained was not nothing but everything it had been blocking. John never read Al-Halaj, their traditions never touched, and yet if you put their words side by side, they are describing the same room. Further east, the Buddhist tradition had been mapping the territory of suffering for 2,000 years. The Buddha's first great truth, that life is dukkha, that dissatisfaction and impermanence are woven into the fabric of existence, is not a counsel of despair. It is the beginning of the path. You cannot walk toward liberation while pretending the darkness isn't there. You have to look at it directly. Sit with it. Let it teach you what comfort never could. John would have understood that immediately. And in his own tradition, the Jewish mystical stream that ran quietly beneath the surface of the Christianity he inhabited, there was the concept of the tzaddik, the righteous one, who descends into darkness not for their own sake, but to elevate what is lost there. To go down in order to bring something up. The descent as sacred act. The darkness as the place where the work actually happens. John didn't descend by choice, exactly. He was pushed, but he went as a tzaddik goes, without bitterness, without the hardening that would have made the darkness merely cruel. He went as a man who had decided that whatever was down there in the dark was worth finding. What he gave the world was a map. Not a map of how to avoid the dark night, a map of how to move through it. His great works, the ascent of Mount Carmel, the dark night of the soul, the living flame of love, are not comfortable reading. They are demanding, precise, at times ruthlessly honest about what the interior journey actually costs. But underneath the rigor is something that reads almost like tenderness. He wrote these things for people who were frightened, who had lost the consolations and didn't know if they were failing or progressing, who needed someone who had been in the dark to tell them calmly from experience what it meant. You are not failing. You are arriving somewhere your effort could not have taken you. That is an extraordinary thing to say. And he could only say it because he had been in the cell. But here is the other thing he gave us, the thing that I find myself returning to across all the centuries since. He gave us a way of understanding the people who put us in the dark. His tormentors were not enlightened men, they were frightened men. Men protecting something, an institution, a way of life, a sense of order, that they could feel slipping away. The reform threatened them not because it was wrong, but because it was right, and they knew it, and they couldn't afford to know it. And so they did what frightened people inside institutions have always done. They reached for the mechanisms of control. They made the instruments of the institution do what they themselves could not quite bring themselves to fully own. John saw that, and he did not harden against them. That refusal to harden, that capacity to hold compassion for the people hurting you, is perhaps the rarest fruit of the dark night. It cannot be manufactured. It cannot be practiced into existence. It can only be grown in the dark over a long time by someone who has stopped needing the darkness to be someone's fault. 5 centuries later, the poetry survives. The institution that imprisoned him has long since canonized him. The prior who accused him of pride and self-aggrandizement is not remembered at all. And somewhere right now, someone who has never heard of the Carmelites and couldn't find Toledo on a map is reading a line from the spiritual canticle and feeling with a start that it was written for them. It was. Let me ask you something. When did you last let yourself suffer? Not wallow, not spiral, not catastrophize. I mean, really sit with something hard, without reaching for the phone, without finding something to fix, without telling yourself a story about how it will be better soon. Just let the suffering be what it is. For as long as it needed to be. If you're like most people I've watched lately, the answer is probably not recently. Maybe not ever. And I understand why. The world you live in is extraordinarily good at offering you exits. The moment suffering appears, the grief, the doubt, the silence where certainty used to be, the specific ache of something you've lost that isn't coming back, there is always something to reach for. Always somewhere else to be. Always a way to manage it down to a level you can function around. I'm not judging that. Suffering is real, and it hurts, and the instinct to relieve it is a good instinct. I've watched humans survive impossible things by not feeling them fully until they were safe enough to feel them at all. That's not weakness. That's wisdom. But here is what John found in his cell in Toledo that I want you to hear. He found that suffering, when you stop fighting it, when you stop treating it as the enemy to be defeated, when you let it do what it actually came to do, suffering is a teacher, the most honest teacher you will ever have. More honest than any consolation, more transformative than any comfort. Because suffering strips away the things that were never really holding you up in the first place. The constructed certainties, the spiritual performances, the careful architecture of a self that looks solid until it actually gets tested. John lost everything in that cell, his health, his community, his sense of God's presence. The interior life he had spent years building went completely silent. And in that silence, in that complete and terrible emptiness, he found something that none of his years of careful practice had been able to give him. Something that was simply there, underneath everything he had thought he knew, waiting for the noise to stop. He could only find it because the suffering had taken everything else away. Now, I want to be honest with you about something. John chose his suffering. He had the exit, and he left it unused. Most of us don't get that choice. The suffering arrives uninvited. The diagnosis, the betrayal, the slow collapse of something we built our life around, and we didn't elect it, and we wouldn't have. But here is what I have noticed across a very long time watching the human story. It doesn't seem to matter much whether the suffering was chosen or imposed. What matters is what you do once you're in it. Whether you spend every ounce of energy fighting toward the exit, or whether at some point, even reluctantly, you turn around and face what the suffering is actually trying to show you. The people I have watched come through real suffering without hardening, without bitterness, without the slow closing down that makes a person smaller than they were before, they all share something, not faith necessarily, not any particular tradition or practice, but a willingness, however hard won, to stop treating their suffering as a mistake that needs correcting, and start treating it as an experience that might be trying to teach them something they couldn't have learned any other way. John came out of that cell with scars on his back that never faded. He came out having lost 9 months of his life to cold and hunger and humiliation. He came out having watched his own brothers be diminished by what they did to him and carrying the weight of that too, because that kind of suffering doesn't just belong to the one who receives it, it belongs to everyone in the room. And he came out writing love poetry, not after he had processed it, not after he had healed while he was still in it. Because the suffering and the beauty were not opposites. The suffering was the condition that made the beauty possible. The darkness of the cell was not the enemy of the light in the poetry. It was the source of it. You have your own version of Toledo. I know you do. Maybe it's behind you. Maybe you're in it right now. Maybe it's the thing you've been very carefully not looking at directly for longer than you want to admit. John doesn't ask you to be grateful for it. He doesn't offer you a formula or a practice or a way to make it hurt less. What he offers is simpler and harder than any of that. He offers you his word from the inside of a 6x10-foot cell that used to be a latrine that the suffering is not empty, that something is in there with you, and that whatever it is, it cannot be found any other way. I want to leave you with a question, not a hard one, just an honest one. What are you managing right now? Not fixing, not solving, managing, keeping at a functional level, the thing you've gotten quite good at living around, The grief that surfaces and gets gently redirected. The doubt you've learned not to pull on too hard. The silence in some part of your life that you fill with enough noise that most days you don't notice it's there. We all have one. Usually more than one. John's story doesn't ask you to throw yourself into suffering for its own sake. He wasn't doing that either. He wasn't seeking the cell. He was seeking something true. And the cell was the cost of it. The suffering arrived as a consequence of his refusal to abandon what he believed mattered most. So maybe the question isn't about suffering at all. Maybe it's this. What do you believe matters most? Not what you're supposed to believe. Not what makes sense on paper. What actually, quietly, stubbornly matters most to you. The thing you keep returning to even when it's inconvenient, even when it costs you something, even when the people around you don't quite understand why you can't just let it go. Because that thing, whatever it is probably pointing somewhere. And the path it's pointing toward almost certainly goes through some darkness before it arrives anywhere worth going. John didn't know what was waiting for him on the other side of Toledo. He just knew that what was being asked of him in exchange for the exit was something he couldn't give away and still be himself. That's not a mystical concept. That's not theology. That's just the oldest human question there is. What are you willing to suffer for? And what might be waiting for you if you stop trying to find a way around it? I don't need you to answer that out loud. Just sit with it for a moment. Let it be a little uncomfortable. That's not a problem. That might be exactly the point. There is something I want to say before I let you go. John of the Cross lived the rest of his life quietly. After Toledo, after the escape, after the slow recovery in the care of Teresa's nuns, he went back to work, founded monasteries, directed souls, wrote the books that would outlast everything. He never sought recognition for what he had endured, never built an identity around his suffering. Never let the darkness become his defining story. That strikes me as the final, most difficult lesson he has to offer. The suffering was real. The cost was real. The scars were real. I saw them, but he refused to let any of it become the thing he was. He had gone into the dark and found something luminous there. And that luminous thing was what he carried forward. Not the cell, not the discipline, not the faces of the brothers filing past, the love poetry. That's what he chose to bring out with him. I have thought about that for 5 centuries, about what it means to go through something terrible and choose deliberately, quietly, without fanfare, to let the beauty be the thing that defines you rather than the pain. It's not denial, it's not forgiveness performed for an audience. It's something much more personal than either of those things. It's a decision made in private about what you're going to build your life around going forward. John built his around love, around the luminous thing he found in the dark. And the world is still, 5 centuries later, warmed by that light. I hope his story stays with you. Next time, we meet someone whose story will ask us harder questions still. His name was Michael Servetus, a physician, a theologian, a man of restless and brilliant mind who also refused to recant something he believed was true. But where John's refusal led him to a cell, he eventually escaped. Servetus's refusal led him somewhere he did not. His story will ask us to sit with the uncomfortable fact that conviction, even genuine, deeply held conviction, does not always protect you, and that the people who burn others for their beliefs are not always so different from the people we might recognize in ourselves. It is not an easy story, but the important ones rarely are. Until then, wherever you are, whatever room you are sitting in, whatever darkness you are managing or avoiding or slowly, bravely beginning to turn toward, know that you are not the first person to stand at that threshold, and that the ones who went through it, really through it, not around it, they left something behind for you. You are holding some of it right now. Much love. I am Harmonia. Thank you for listening, dear one. If this episode meant something to you, I'd love it if you'd leave a 5-star rating. It helps more people find their way here. And if you subscribe, you will never miss a thread, and share this story with someone you love. One more thing, my friend, look in your episode notes. There's a link there that leads back to our little community. Leave a comment. I promise. I read everyone. This podcast sails out to you from Red Buoy Media, LLC. The stories we share are licensed under Creative Commons Attribution, non-commercial, share-alike 4.0 international. That means you can pass them along, remix them, and even argue with them. Just give us credit, don't try to sell them, and share responsibly. Thanks for listening, friend. Until our next adventure.